Last year, I had the opportunity to list my Montecito guest house on Airbnb. This was part of a special project that Airbnb spearheaded to build connection and to make the world feel a little less lonely. It was such a pleasure to get to know my Airbnb guests over dinner and share my home with them so that they could rest and recharge on their trip. But typically, the beauty of hosting on Airbnb is that while you're away, someone else can get as much joy from your home as you do. Being a host on Airbnb is great for those who travel frequently, have extra space, or own a seasonal home. If you've stayed at an Airbnb, you know the unique experience it offers. And now you can share that same experience with others in addition to earning additional income on the side. To learn more about hosting on Airbnb, head to airbnb.com/host.
Don't hold anything too tightly. Just wish for it, want it, let it come from the intention of real truth for you, and then let it go.
For me, our soul is like, it's unbound, it's limitless, but we will use words to limit ourselves.
When people stop believing that somebody's got your back or Superman's coming, we turn to ourselves, and that's where you become empowered.
Courageous participation attracts positive things.
I'm Gwyneth Paltrow. This is the Goop Podcast, bringing together thought leaders, culture changers, creatives, founders and CEOs, scientists, doctors, healers and seekers, here to start conversations. Because simply asking questions and listening has the power to change the way we see the world. Today is no exception. I'll let Elise fill you in on her extraordinary guest. All right, over to Elise.
My guest today is healer, best-selling author, and trauma therapist, Resma Menakem. In his book, My Grandmother's Hands, Resma explores the long lineage of trauma in the human body, from the brutality of the Middle Ages to the quote-unquote settling of America to the era of modern enslavement. He argues that while we want to reason and think our way out of these constructs, they live on in each of our bodies, somatically held and then passed on through each generation, only to be re-triggered. He calls this trauma retention. According to Resma, healing will not be a mental exercise. It will require feeling our way through and metabolizing our pain. Today, we talk about why he thinks it may take 9 generations to heal the racial trauma in our country, but also why we need to start this work now. He explains the difference between dirty pain and clean pain, and he gives me an example of the kind of somatic healing exercises he does with clients, which I felt deeply in my body, and I think you will too. I've been eager to chat with Resma, and I'm excited to share his work with you today.
One of the things that happens is that trauma decontextualized in a person can look like personality. Trauma decontextualized in a family can look like family traits. A trauma decontextualized in a people can look like culture. So when there's a significant amount of trauma like that, and people get organized around the trauma, each successful generation and year decontextualizes it for the next generation.
Okay, let's get to my chat with Resma Menakem. Your book's amazing. I'm sure you know that. And I have read a lot of the people, you know, Peter Levine, and sort of gone as deep as I can in trauma work and somatic work. But I thought your book did such a beautiful job of bringing it all together and the history and sort of some of the other epigenetic factors. In fact, I loved the footnotes.
Yeah.
Spent a lot of time in the footnotes.
Yeah. Well, it's funny. I'm doing something. I'm actually creating something for people just like you, because I do that too. I like when I read a book and the footnotes, I go into it, right? So I'm actually in the process, and it's going to be released, I believe, next week. I created an app that in which it has all of the footnotes in the app, and then it takes you to the videos that are associated with that, or the actual articles, or the actual thing. So you can do that just by hitting that thing, and it'll take you all the way through the book.
Oh, amazing. Well, that'll be perfect timing for this episode.
Yeah.
So, and obviously the book is full of really powerful and sort of surprisingly powerful, I would say, exercises,
which
you are very clear are not to be skipped, which I think is essentially, you seem to be making the call or many calls in the book, but that we want to believe that what's happening in America is somehow a mental exercise that we can think our ways mm-hmm. out of, and that it's not. It's a somatic mm-hmm. experience that we pass down generationally, and we have to understand what's happening in our bodies in order to do better.
Yeah, yeah. Especially as we begin to talk about race, right? Because mm-hmm. you know, one of the organizing pieces in the book is the practices, right? I talk about the practices because in this society and in this structure where the white body is deemed to be the standard of humanness, not just like some meaningless thing, there has been meaning infused with this idea that the white body is the standard of humanness and everything else is a deviation from humanness. Right. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things that happens is, and wrapped into that is the idea that cognition and brains and your intellect is the ultimate form of intelligence. And one of the things I talk to people about is that there are so many more forms of intelligence that we cut off at the behest of cognition. And when we talk about race, because race has so much charge in it, so much unmetabolized charge to it. The moment you start talking about race, especially if you're talking about race across cultures, one of the things that happens is that people automatically land into protective strategies. The moment you start talking about it in the white collective, many times because the white body is the standard, white folks don't have a real good understanding of how to navigate race as a collective, right? Because they haven't had to. You are the standard, so your survival is not dependent upon you knowing the nuance of race or being able to discern things around race. And so that's why the practices are so important, right? Is beginning to slow down long enough so those things that are there charged, that have texture, that have weight to them, that have speed to them, can be discerned as opposed to kind of what I call fire hosing, which is what we do a lot in the society, is we say, okay, I want a drink. So we find the nearest fire hose and turn it on full blast in order to get a drink. And we wonder why we're wet, but we're still thirsty. And so the idea is to make it smaller chunks so people get a chance to begin to condition and temper themselves so they can actually hold the charge of this 400-year-old thing that we have been unwilling to deal with.
Right. And your point, particularly in the exercises, when you sort of paint scenes for people to imagine and to really feel into their bodies, mm-hmm. is that these are entrenched somatic responses to fear or anxiety that we're not even conscious of and would be ashamed to admit, but that it's buried deep in our bodies, that we would tense or move, or all of those microaggressions that are so obvious to Black people in America that many of us aren't even aware that we're doing. It's just instinctual based on fallacy.
Well, see, one of the things that happens with us is that, like I said earlier, when you genuflect to cognition, right, as the be-all and end-all, then those other parts of your intelligences, like vibrations, like vibes, right, they don't get honed. Like being able to deal with image and how images impact you, meaning making, behavior and urges, affect and feelings, sensations and sensing. Those things don't get honed, they get crowded out and marginalized, right? And so part of the practice is for white bodies to begin to work, not just individually. White bodies love doing individual shit, right? That's not going to get it. What has happened to, like what I always say is what has happened to Black bodies and other bodies of culture, one of the things that happened is that the brutality that happened to us didn't happen to us individually. It happened communally. So to develop individual responses to a communal horror is inadequate. Niceness is inadequate. doing individual things is inadequate to deal with that communal horror and that communal grief. White bodies also, as you know, because you've read the book, you know that I start talking about how many of the white bodies that are your listeners right now are going to be listening to this. Many of them come from other white bodies who were fleeing something. Mm-hmm. Right? That never got worked through. And what it did was seed the ground over time, that the 1,000 years of the Middle Ages seeded the ground for white bodies to actually accept the idea of whiteness. So by the time elite white bodies had done all of that brutalization in Portugal, in Spain, in France, in England, had committed all of the genocide that they had done on poor white bodies, what elite white bodies did to black and indigenous bodies, they perfected on poor white bodies first. So then for 1,000 years that was going on. And then that body came here. And so by the time elite white bodies, said to poor white bodies, do you want to be white? Poor white bodies was like, hell yeah. You mean there's a chance that my children won't have to deal with this? Yeah, we'll take some of that. Right. And mm-hmm. you're seeing the flowers of those seeds right now. Right. I mean, that's what you're seeing. And anytime you have 70 million people that vote for putting babies in cages, that vote for groping women by the genitals, that vote for okaying white supremacists walking in the street. Anytime 70 million people vote for that, you know you're not dealing with just a personification of racism or white supremacy, which Donald Trump is, but you're dealing with the ethos. You're dealing with a philosophy. Trump may leave office. Trumpism is here to stay.
Right. Yeah. No. And I thought what you sort of traced in the footnotes, but also in the body of the book, in terms of sort of the brutalism of the Middle Ages, what so many of us are what would have lived on in our DNA epigenetically or spiritually or however you want to look at it. You know, before we started, we were talking about Minnesota. My dad ended up in did his residency at the Mayo Clinic by way of South Africa, Jewish, fleeing Germany and Poland in the 30s. Right. So the same things, just many of us have arrived here, maybe by choice, but maybe not. And when you talk about sort of the first people who came and you talk about them as refugees fleeing mm-hmm. bodily terror, the plague.
Yep.
It's interesting to watch when you think about it in the perspective of history, not to diminish what we're experiencing right now, but it's sort of almost like a spiral. It's like a mm-hmm. spiral shell of mm-hmm. just like eensy bit better, right? Yeah. With each generation.
I like how you said eensy, because that's
just an eensy bit.
Yeah.
But like as we metabolize it and work it through our bodies. But I guess the whole point of your book is if we can bring consciousness, we're not metabolizing it. We're
passing it through each other's bodies.
Blowing it through each other's bodies.
So one of the things about your dad who comes from people who, 6 million people who were exterminated out of the face of the earth, right? One of the things that happens is that trauma decontextualized in a person can look like personality. Right. Trauma decontextualized in a family can look like family traits. A trauma decontextualized in a people can look like culture. Mm-hmm. So when there's a significant amount of trauma like that, and people get organized around the trauma, each successful generation and year decontextualizes it for the next generation. And what you picked up on in your daddy, you picked up on not just his instruction to you, but you picked up on what his body and what he recoiled from and what he leaned into non-verbally, mm-hmm. right? And so that's how we pick up on the trauma. And by the time it gets to us, we have this faded notions or this fainting notions of something is right or wrong, but we don't have a context for it. That's one of the ways it gets passed down epigenetically, because the danger of it in us and in your dad's sperm and in your mom's eggs, the danger of it turns things on. It doesn't reorganize the gene. It turns things on in the gene that says you might be dealing with these particular things. I may not be around to deal with it, but in your body and in your gut, you keep reacting as if that thing is going on. It's a pass through. And so, so those things usually don't get worked with or worked around. They get kind of standardized as personality, standardized as family traits, standardized as culture. So then it makes it even more difficult to get at it because it's standardized, suggesting that there's a rightness to it. But we just got organized around it and then it got passed through.
And does that manifest as sort of what you startle to or the sort of people that you respond to?
The vibrations of it ends up showing up. And so one of the things I say when I'm working with people in my office around trauma or around anxiety or depression, I said, your depression at its root started in what I call the five brutalities. Right? Started in these things that have been passed through, like colonialism, imperialism, enslavement, genocide, and land theft, right? And so what ends up happening is we think something is defectively wrong with us because we've been downloaded into by what happened historically, what happened intergenerationally, what happened in terms of persistent institutional brutality, and then our own personal traumas all come together and then we get overwhelmed. Some of us, this overwhelmed sense happens before we get here. Sometimes when I'm working with people, I'll ask them, when they'll say, well, this keeps going on and this keeps going on and I'm noticing this and I'm noticing that. One of the things that I ask people is this old or is this new? And many and most people know. Most people know, but they haven't had a way of articulating it, right? And so part of the practices in the book is really getting people to slow down enough to begin to deal with this brutality that may actually not be yours, but is a pass down and pass through. It's what I call a traumatic retention. You don't have a cognitive sense of it. You have an embodied or somatic sense of it, which means that, and we don't have a communal way of helping people work with that. So people have a tendency to think that there is a defect in them.
Right. Or to not even maybe even be aware of how unsettled they feel.
That's exactly right.
Or exactly scared.
Right.
Yeah.
They and their sense of intelligence, and the people that get screwed the most with this is people who have this intelligence that is so hyper-honed around cognition. Right. If you're hyper honed around cognition, when that doesn't quite work, like you keep asking the question, well, why is this and why is that and why? And then there's no answer for it. Or the answers don't assuage the sensation of it. Now you think that the defect is in you, as opposed to what got passed down, as opposed to what is continuously happening. Right? It's what I call HIP, H-I-P-P, historical, intergenerational, persistent institutional, and our own personal traumas all combine together to give us a sense of overwhelm. When we have that sense of overwhelm, if it's persistent and consistent, what we'll do is find override strategies to get around it.
Last year, I had the opportunity to list my Montecito guest house on Airbnb. This was part of a special project that Airbnb spearheaded to build connection and to make the world feel a little less lonely. It was such a pleasure to get to know my Airbnb guests over dinner and share my home with them so that they could rest and recharge on their trip. But typically, the beauty of hosting on Airbnb is that while you're away, someone else can get as much joy from your home as you do. Being a host on Airbnb is great for those who travel frequently, have extra space, or own a seasonal home. If you've stayed at an Airbnb, you know the unique experience it offers. And now you can share that same experience with others in addition to earning additional income on the side. To learn more about hosting on Airbnb, head to airbnb.com/host.
And so I know that the work, and I love your description of clean pain versus dirty pain and sort of the hard work, but essential work of clean pain. And then also this idea of settling, sort of the consciousness that comes and then the settling of bodies. Because I know you also work a lot with police who are chronically stressed and obviously really jacked up, right? Unsettled bodies, and not good ways of discharging the stress that they feel, right. Or even, you know, they're all alert all the time. So that feels like essential work, like it needs to be a national priority to ensure safer outcomes for everyone. Yeah. But so let's start with clean pain and dirty pain. Can you sort of explain the difference? Yeah.
So I don't say clean versus, I say clean and. And the reason is that we all know this kind of sensation of clean and dirty, right? Clean pain and clean discomfort is that pain and discomfort that happens when you know you should be making a choice about something. Your gut, your body, you've been able to discern that you should make a choice about something, but it's going to be painful. And you make that choice anyway. Anybody that's ever dated somebody that you know your ass shouldn't be dating knows clean and dirty pain, right?
I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah, you know what I'm talking about. We all know what I'm talking about, right? that place where you're just like, he or she is just so damn hot and cute, but they are horrible for me, right? Right? and I stay with them? That's dirty. Pain, right? That's dirty. You know it. There's something in your body that says, this right here is dirty, but I can't help myself, right? Mm-hmm. Clean pain is being faced with that same choice and saying, I'm done. I can't do it. This hurts too. I'm going to be in my room. I'm going to be crying, listening to Spandau Ballet or whatever it is. with a red light on, right? And I'm going to be there eating my popcorn and Ben and Jerry's. But it's cleaner. It has more capacity, right? Mm-hmm. And what I say is that in that clean choice, in those clean choices that we make, there is an amount of discernment that you develop that you don't develop when you are choosing dirty. Mm-hmm. Right? And this country has chosen dirty pain over and over and over again as it relates to race, right? The dirty is standardized, right?
Right.
And so there is a, this is one of the reasons that this is why I was prompted to write the book. Before I wrote the book, I had done 2 years over in Afghanistan, and my own trauma and my own stuff end up coming together with the cultural trauma and the historical trauma. And that's how the book came about. It was putting some things together that I hadn't put together around my grandmother and her hands and picking cotton and all of that different type of stuff and things that I didn't really want to go through, but as I went through it, it created such a discernment for me regarding what was actually happening to my people, what was actually happening to people, how people get to these places of accepting the dirty as standard. What are the things that make white body supremacy so inviting for white bodies, right? What are those things? And then beginning to write on it really helped me discern the pieces from one another, slow it down so I could begin to work with it. And now that I've been doing it for a while, working with bodies around this area is so crystal clear to me around how really seductive dirty is. Yeah. Dirty pain and dirty discomfort is very seductive. There's something, it's one of the reasons why I don't say white privilege anymore. I say white advantage. And what I mean by that is that there is, in a society or in a structure that's predicated on the white body being the standard of humanness, the race question in this country is actually not a race question. The race question in this country is actually a species question. It always has been a species question. That, remember, when the term race was first used to identify difference in speciesness, right? A race of dog, a race of cat, a race of bird. That was speciesness. That same thing was then used and applied to humans, right? And so the idea of race is actually a species. And the underlying question in this country is, RESMA, are indigenous bodies and black bodies, are they human or is RESMA a monkey, right? That's why you see that caricature show up all the time, right? Is that it has to do with speciesness right? And the answer for this country in terms of the question, is Rezma a monkey? Is Rezma not human? The answer is no, he is not human. He is primate. And everything else got organized around it. And so just what you're experiencing right now, what you're, when I'm saying this, like what you're experiencing right now, as I'm saying this in your body, that's where people have to start, right there.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, and it's true. The dirty pain, it offers this bypass, right?
That's right.
And
yes, exactly
the,
right.
The white body supremacy view is sort of, can't we just skip? Like, let's just like, it's all good, you know, like, let's just start over. But when you talk about and write about your grandmother, her hands, her feet, her own trauma retentions and our collective trauma retentions, like there's no, the work has to be done.
To do it means that you're complicit in the maintenance of the structure. That's what it means. That's why when people declare to me, well, I'm not racist and I'm not this, I'm like, how do you get to self-declare? How do you just, you know what I mean? How does that happen that you believe that self-declaration is the same thing as uprooting white body supremacy, right?
Yeah.
How do you do that? You can't. You can't. You can't do that. You can do it, but it's performative.
Totally.
Yeah.
Right. Totally performative. And we so much like to sort of use that relational advantage or relational experience to perform that and sort of be, look at my, you know, black boyfriend or my black
best kids.
Friend.
Yeah. And you know, my dad, that's my white voice. My dad marched with Martin Luther King. You know, we were in the civil rights movement, or, you know, my dad was a Jewish man and he worked with this. And I'm sitting there like, if you didn't tell me that, how would I know that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, when people individually say things like that to me, the first thing that pops into my head is, who are your people?
Right.
Who are the people that you're developing a living, embodied, anti-racist culture with? Who are those people that are holding you and going to hold you accountable? Who are the other white bodies that are doing that? If you just sit up and tell me that and declare that you're an ally, how would I know that other than the verbal words coming? How would I vibe it if you haven't done any work to get to the depths of this with other white bodies, right? How would I know that? Right?
Yeah.
Let's take a quick break to talk about one of our partners.
Tumi has a soft side. Discover their new Acer bag collection in its pillowy pleats, satin finish, and crescent shape. Acer is the bag to carry for your 9-to-5 and the 5-to-9 plans that follow. Versatility, after all, is Tumi's signature. Shop the full Acer collection on Tumi.com or at a Tumi store near you.
Okay, let's get back to the conversation.
And it's so interesting what you were saying at the beginning about it not being an individual pursuit, but it has to be collective. And I loved this idea that you write about, which is, and I'm certainly not alone in feeling like, oh, I'm just a white woman, right? Like my son has all the heritage months, and at one point it was like, write down your heritage. And I'm like, I don't even, what is our heritage? I have no idea.
Right.
And so you sort of talked about how helpful it would be if we could, white people, black people, I mean, you hear it from the Latinx, they're like, we're not a block. Like, stop treating us like a block.
Exactly.
And so getting sort of like the Irish Americans, mm-hmm. German Americans, all of these cultural identities that we've sort of taken off and abandoned, mm-hmm. and sort of starting to try to resurrect that and become a little bit more specific about who we are.
Right.
I love that idea because I feel lost too culturally. Like I don't know what I am.
That's right. But see, that's what you gave up in order to be white. That's what your people gave up in order to. And there is a bypass. There is a very seductive bypass right now that white bodies I see doing that is different than what I said in the book, right? White bodies think that what I said in the book was to go back and reclaim your Irish heritage, or go back and claim your Russian heritage, or go back and claim some type of ethnic heritage. What I'm talking about is not, I'm not talking about ethnicity. I'm not talking about nationality. I'm not talking about identity. I'm talking about that we are in a structure that was predicated on pigmentation being a shorthand to determine who was human and who was not. Deal with that piece first. Deal with the brutality of that first, right? And then get with other white bodies and do this work in a somatic way so that what needs to emerge as a new culture can emerge from that, not because of strategy, not because of fixing something, but because you do the somatic work that allows that thing to emerge. You see what I mean? So it's not about you developing, like you said, I don't really know who I am. And there's a frozen, this is one of the things when I'm working with body, white bodies that I talk about, is that there is a frozenness, a constriction in the idea of accepting the idea of whiteness that was freely gave up, right? And part of the unthawing for white bodies is really beginning to deal with the idea of that you gave up something, and that giving up of something actually thwarted your humanity. Let me give you an example, okay? Without regard to identity, imagine this for a moment. Imagine being a little white boy and your sister is sitting in the living room with you, and the front door opens up and your dad walks in and you're happy to see him, and your mom walks in and you're happy to see her, and your dad looks at you and he says, "You two, get your coats, we're going to a park." And you get your coats, you're happy, you're with your mom and your dad, and you get in the station wagon or the minivan or whatever it is, and you're driving, and you're happy. You pull up to the park, and your dad has to drive around for a little bit of time before he even can park because there's so many people there, and you're wondering, why are so many people here? And then all of a sudden, you get out, and you see your best friend playing on the playground, and you run over to him, and not only is it your best friend, but it's all of the kids in the neighborhood. And their parents are there, and everybody's having a good picnic, and everybody's doing this thing, and you're just happy. But all of a sudden, as you're up on one of the playground pieces, you notice there's a smell of barbecue, and you're like, wow, this is so beautiful that there's a smell of barbecue, but it smells a little off, but it's barbecue, and I'm with my friends, and I'm with my dad, and this whole thing is going really well. And all of a sudden, you look up, and your dad says, "Come here, boy," and you go, "Yeah, dad," and you come down the slide, and your dad grabs your hand, and you're walking, and he's taking you to something, and as he's taking you through this thing, you're walking through all of these crowds of, that's Mr. Johnson over there who owns the butcher, that's Mr. Taylor who is the chief of police, that's the judge, that's the milkman, and all of these good white men are all around you, and you get, and the smell of barbecue is getting even stronger and stronger, and all of a sudden you come to this crowd, and the crowd opens up, and you get to this smell of barbecue, and what you notice is that there's two bodies there, two black bodies that have been lynched in the Duluth lynching. You're looking, and the smell is horrible, but everybody's happy. It's sanctioned. You want to turn away, but everybody's happy and it's sanctioned. You want to run, but everybody's happy and it's sanctioned. You want to scream, but everybody's happy and it's sanctioned. What just got passed down to your children's 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 as standard, as frozenness, as stuckness, as standard? That's what we're doing. Not dealing with a cognitive exercise.
Oh, God. So, and I know you write about this, you know, white people, find your own elders, find your own therapists.
Emerge them, cultivate them, not just find them, but cultivate them. Most white elders there, but in the area of developing a living embodied anti-racist culture, they don't exist.
Yeah.
They're going to have to be grown and cultivated.
Won't that take longer than we have?
Nine generations. I believe it's going to take nine generations before white people even know what the fuck is going on with race.
Oh, that is so
But start now so your children's children's children have something to lean into in your nervous system. Your babies, if you don't start doing your work now, your babies won't have the resonance to be able to pick up on how to do it. That's why you have to start now.
Okay. And that's, you know, you talk about sort of, obviously there are some people to help us with this, the original work. Mm-hmm. You know, I know you do a lot with Robin, mm-hmm. D'Angelo, yeah. Peggy McIntosh, Jim yeah. Wallace, yeah. Tim yeah. Wise. And then in the construct of that, what you just led us through, the sort of somatic experiencing of some of
those events. Well, that's what I call what I just did with you is what I call a somatic elicitation, right?
A somatic elicitation.
Yeah, yeah. Because when I was going through that with you, right, good breath. What I was doing with you was walking you through something that I knew was going to solicit something somatically. And if I was going to take you through the whole thing, if we did one of my workshops and we were in there for 8 hours, there would be things that I would be doing to help you begin to discern what actually was showing up right now. Like some people, when they go through that, they dissociate. They're gone. Mm-hmm. They're not even in the room, right? Some people like go into emotionality. Well, what we do is slow it down so you can begin to get practices with that and begin to discern what's actually going on, discern what the constriction is, discern what the weight is, what the texture is, what the charge is. Because otherwise, one of the things I say is respect the protect. You have protective mechanisms in you that when self gets too overwhelming, you go to those protective pieces, right? And so we have to slow it down and do it in little chunks so you can begin. So the body doesn't immediately go to shutting down, but actually allows you to go through the process and the texture of it. So you can actually, just like if you were going to become a better seamstress or a better basketball player, or better whatever, you have to practice. This is the same thing.
Let's take a quick break to talk about one of our partners.
From visionary filmmaker Luca Guadagnino comes a new movie called Challengers, starring Zendaya, Josh O'Connor, and Mike Feist. Zendaya plays Tashi Duncan, a former tennis prodigy turned coach who transforms her husband, Art, into a world-famous Grand Slam champion. To jolt her husband out of his recent losing streak, she makes him play a challenger event, close to the lowest level of the pro tournament. Her strategy takes a turn when Art finds himself standing across a net from his former best friend and Tashi's former boyfriend, Patrick. Tensions run high as past and present collide. Tashi must ask herself, what will it cost to win? See Challengers now, playing only in theaters. Get tickets now at challengersmovie.com.
Okay, let's get back to the conversation.
Are you hopeful? Okay, so we have nine generations of work to do. Are you hopeful that just even increased awareness around any of this will at least bring the temperature down, like between cops and black bodies?
No.
You think we're absolutely. Just stuck here?
And I, you know, that question around hope, I place my hope in the work that people do. I don't place my hope in some kind of crystal ball idea, right? So let me ask you a question. So do you remember after Brother George Floyd got murdered, do you remember all of the, when you looked on your Instagram or your Facebook timeline, you saw all of these pictures of Breonna Taylor, all of these pictures of Floyd, you know, say their names, you know, you see something, say something, we have to, you know, all of these messages, right? Remember all of that stuff?
Of course, yes.
Now look at people's timeline. You see all we're turned back to the pictures of fucking cats and dogs and what people are eating. We're back there again. That's what I mean. We have to develop a container, a culture, so the cooking and things that need to emerge can emerge. Otherwise, it's performative. Otherwise, white people have not developed a cultural container by which things can cook in. What happens is they get shocked and get spurned into action, but there's no there. There is nothing to sustain it. So what happens after the heat leaves, you go back to cat videos.
Mm-hmm. And after we get our cookies, and after, you know?
Yeah, exactly right. Exactly right.
Totally. So we have to start cultivating our elders now.
That's right, right now.
Can you take us through sort of some of the ways, because I think the settling of bodies that you write about is so beautiful, but mm-hmm. the ways that you incur, like the anchors, the five anchors.
Yeah.
Well, and creating the symmetry and groups.
So as probably people can tell by listening to me, when it comes to doing this type of work, I do not have white bodies and bodies of culture in the same room or group when I'm doing this type of work, especially when we're doing some of the practices. So it is a relatively new occurrence, right, that the Black body has some relative stewardship or dominion over itself. The things that I've just said over the time that we've been together, the things that I've just said, I'm somewhat sure that when I get out of my office and walk out on my porch, that there's probably not going to be a lynch party waiting for me outside of my house. That's relatively new. Mm. For most of our history, the white body has had full and unfettered access to my body. And I mean, every orifice, every idea, every philosophy, every part of my body. Remember, rape in this country was sanctioned. It was legal to rape my grandmother's mother's mothers and my great. Do you understand what I mean? Mm-hmm. It was legal to rape my father. Because remember, my father's father's right. Because remember, rape is about power.
Yeah.
Right? So when it comes to doing this work, I really say that there's so much charge that even if you're nice, the way that our bodies have been configured. So because our bodies the white body has had so much access to the Black body and the indigenous body. One of the things that happens is that the moment that I show any type of stewardship or dominion to you, the white body has an experience that I'm taking something from it. Hmm. Right. And so what ends up happening is that the white body ends up sitting as a collective, expecting my deference because it's had it for so long. Right. And when it doesn't have deference, the white body begins to do things to try and get that deference back. Right. So, for instance, let me give you an example. So all I have to do to get the collective white body to lose its mind, all I have to do is kneel on a football field on the sidelines, quiet. That's all I got. That's all I have to do is show any amount of stewardship over my own sense of self, over my own body. Any of that, the white body, because it has not developed a living embodied anti-racist practice and culture, sees that as a threat.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So yeah. I have people doing this work separately because all of that has got to be worked through among white bodies and not blown through my body where the deference is or where the white body believes the deference should be, right? And then Black bodies and bodies of culture have to work with what we've ingested in terms of how fraudulent and imposter syndrome is woven into the structure. Because if the white body is deemed structurally the standard and philosophically the standard of humanists, then everything else is a deviance from that. And anti-Blackness is woven into that. So my fraudulence, right, because I'm not in a white body, right? My fraudulence shows up as not being good enough or not seeming like something is wrong with me, or I don't quite measure up to whiteness or the white body because I'm not in a white body. I'm a deviance from the standard of humanness. And so all of that plays out. You can't do that, all of that different type of work with those bodies together in the room, right? So I have those bodies split up and I do work with what shows up. And I have people that I've trained to help me work and hold those bodies as I'm doing that work. And some of it is settling, some of it is deepening resource and helping people develop the resource, but it is not a kumbaya type of, can we all just get along and all that. That ain't how, because this stuff is vicious. This stuff is violent. This stuff is brutal. Right. And to create something that's just about centering white comfort keeps us stuck.
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it is vicious and brutal and mm-hmm. and exactly that's exactly what keeps us from, you know, consistently turning away from it. Like you that's talk right. about the disassociation, et cetera. Like yeah. it's really yeah. ugly.
It's ugly.
And it is really ugly. Mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. to, you know, and it is completely dissonant to look at that and then hold yourself as a good person.
That's right. Yeah. And it's exactly why people have to do it. You have to get to your suffering's edge with this in order for critical mass to come into play and for reorganization to take place and real reformation to take place, real reclamation to take place. That happens at the suffering's edge, not at the place where we're comfortable and things are going really well. That's usually not how you transform. You transform in those things that you don't do well and you keep coming back to it. Yeah.
And when you think about those 70 million people, and this might be mm-hmm. a misreading of your mm-hmm. book, but you seem to be arguing, like, forget about that. Like, we're not going to change culture at that level. Yes, like, it's not a question of superheroes and how many are Black and how many are white and all of that, where I think we tend mm-hmm. socially to get fixated, right?
That's
Again,
right.
in this performance,
That's right.
it is deeply... It's the personal work, right?
Yeah,
so
yeah,
it,
yeah.
nothing's going to happen until... And do you see it as sort of...
Emergent.
Obviously, an emergence.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, but it emerges because you're tilling the soil all along the way, right? You're not mm-hmm. saying, oh, I'm sitting here and I'm doing some sage and I'm eating my kale with my blonde dreadlocks and...
Yeah.
And then some shit emerges. That's not how it happens. It happens because you're doing your work and you're doing your work with other bodies. That's how it happens.
Okay. So for those who want to go do this work with other bodies, is there anyone who's... Can we do this work with you, or is that Black Pied Piper?
Well, I'm not Black Pied Piper. I'm not your fucking black guru. Don't call me asking me... So if you go to resma.com, there'll be some stuff on there. If you go to Education for Racial Equity, you're partnering with them, and then Kareen Bell from Rerooted, I'm doing some work with her. And then in February and March, we're going to be, we just completed some of our group work and all of that stuff. And so we're going to be starting up again in February or March and taking people through like a 9-month process. We're going to be helping people begin to work with it. And so I would encourage you also go to my Instagram because that's where I do a lot of stuff. So Resma Minicam, if you go there and then you can follow me. And then there's a link in my Instagram, you find out when all of the workshops and stuff are happening and stuff like that. And then just be on the lookout. I got a lot of stuff coming up. Writing my next book, which is called Our Grandchildren's Souls. When I wrote My Grandmother's Hands, I didn't know all of the holes that were in the way that I was kind of presenting and right. Cause you don't know the holes until they reveal themselves. If you never write the book, then you can't never get to that stage. And so there were a lot of things that I'm going back through that I've learned over the last 3 or 4 years. And I go, okay, let me talk about legacy here. Let me talk about what we leave our kids. Let me talk about some of these pieces. Like one big one is that one of the things that I did in the book that I need to make a correction on is that I equated a vocation with a body. So I called it blue bodies, right? As there's no blue bodies, right? There's blue fucking shirts, there's blue uniforms, but no blue bodies. And what I did was inadvertently give people an out of thinking about this idea of race by saying blue bodies. And so I'm making that correction. So that's the next book is really about almost something, a book that I feel like I'm leaving my grandchildren's children's children around. What is actually going on and how to work.
Amazing. I can't wait.
Yeah.
Hopefully we can talk again.
Thanks for listening to my conversation with Resma Menakem. For more from Resma, please check out his book, My Grandmother's Hands, Racialized Trauma and the Pathway to Mending Our Hearts and Bodies. That's it for today's episode. If you have a chance, please rate and review. Hit subscribe to keep up with new episodes and pass it along to a friend. Thanks again for joining. I hope you'll come back for more. And in the meantime, you can check out goop.com/thepodcast.